Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. What a really nice turnout. We've not been here now for how long?
Since COVID.
Before COVID.
Before COVID.
Right, so maybe 2019 is one of your books then?
Might be 4 years, yeah.
And we've been together his entire career, so, you know, I've really missed him. But we have been good and we have Zoomed for everyone.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. Thank you. But it's nice to be in person and thank you all for coming.
It really is. And if any of you missed any conversations about his previous books, you can go to our website and click into either YouTube or Facebook, because you don't have to belong to Facebook to do it. And you can go back and check out the Zooms for those events. They're also podcasts. So if you don't want to watch it, you can actually just download and listen to it. So we're versatile, right? We are actually 17 authors shy of 1,000 authors. We're at 217,000 downloads just for the podcast.
Wow. I told Barbara I'd come back 17 times.
Anyway, as you all know, Bob is an incredibly versatile author. And while he started out writing legal thrillers, he's branched off into Seattle police. We've done chess. We've done Russian spies. We've done Sam Hill, which is literary. You're never bored.
No. I just love to write, and I feel very blessed that I get the opportunity to do it, and I just don't want to be constrained by a genre. I'll give you a real quick good example. I was cleaning out the attic, and I found what looked like photo albums, and I opened it up, and they were newspaper clippings. They were newspaper clippings from 1933. And I said to my wife, well, what are these? She looks and says, oh, that was my grandfather. He was a very prominent lawyer in Seattle. And she said, he kept newspaper clippings. And I was like, wow. And I started flipping through them. And it turns out that in 1933, in the middle of Prohibition, right, while the Great Depression is going on, there was a nightclub in Seattle called the Pom Pom Club. On Profanity Hill. Now, if that doesn't scream story, I don't know what does.
It was even alliterative, even better.
Yeah, and so they called it Profanity Hill. It was actually first still in Seattle because there was a cable car that went up the hill, and it used to break down all the time. So the judges, the lawyers, and the litigants, to get to the courthouse, which was atop the hill, had to climb up, including 100 steps, and they'd be swearing the whole time. So it became known as Profanity Hill. So anyway, there was a murder in the Pom Pom Club by the owner of the Pom Pom Club, who was an underworld figure, and he killed a lightweight boxer. And then, why did he do it? And I just thought, this is just too good to pass up. And I literally had clippings from the three major newspapers from the day of the shooting until the day of it was finally concluded. So I said, I'm writing this one.
Hardly even nonfiction. I mean, almost nonfiction in a way.
But... yeah, I took two true stories and blended them together. And I can't tell you the second true story because I can't tell you. I can tell you it didn't.
So you're referring to this book, right?
No. I'm talking about the other. This, though, it does have a true story in it. Yes.
It does, right. So for those of you who get our e-news, I mentioned to you that there's a Golden Age mystery by a Golden Age author. It has a similar, anyway, there is a similar thing that happens in it. And I didn't want to tell any of you in case you'd read it, because then you could work out the real truth behind this plot. But if any of you want to know, you can email me and I will tell you. I looked it up today to make sure that I remember which book by this Golden Age author is the same thing. But anyway,
you don't have to tell me.
I'll tell you at dinner, right? Because now nobody could accuse you of plagiarizing it, for heaven's sake. It's completely different, but it's fun. Anyway, I was going to say that Bob is now leading his best life, which is he gets to write books as he wishes with a publisher who lets him do everything. But there were some dark days back there.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember sitting down with Bob in a hotel room when he was really thinking of quitting and telling him he couldn't and rallying him.
Yeah, in fact, when I was let go by Simon & Schuster, I had to come up with a new character. And I was down here for some reason.
Yeah, we were in my library.
Winter. And I said, this is what I'm thinking of doing. And Barb said, no. She said, do this. And that was the birth of Tracy Crosswhite. Mm. And so I kind of sat down and said, well, I'm thinking about doing this. And Barb said, did you think of this? And we pretty much plotted out My Sister's Grave, which was the book that put me on the map. So when people ask me why I come down to Phoenix, I say, when Barb says jump, I say, how high?
You know, you did have a successful legal practice, you know, you did have a whole lawyer thing going on, but you really wanted to write, and you didn't want to go back to practicing law, but, you know, you were at that crossroads where you might have had to do that if Tracy hadn't, in fact, been a success.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's life gets in the way, right? I'm married, I have two kids, they're now grown. But back at that time, they were still, you know, high school, and you got to pay tuition and all those things. And I tell people all the time that there was a number of moments. I can remember being in a New York hotel room after I had just been let go, and I was doing my George Costanza routine. I had my two buddies there, and I was looking at them, and I was saying, I could be a sportscaster. Maybe I could work in a bookstore and just, you know, throwing stuff out. And, you know, you try to laugh through it, but it's hard when you feel like your dreams maybe are going away. But I'm one of 10 kids, and my mother, the whole time I was growing up, was like, you know, tough chin, stick it, you know, keep your chin up, go forward. And I did. And here we are.
So Bob's going to pay me back by revealing who his hairstylist is. So envious. Was that not a great haircut?
And I told Barb, the funny thing is, the place I go is just this little store right up the block from me. And you can't request a person to cut your hair. So I have to kind of go in and see what number I have. Where she's got another car. No, I'm not ready yet. I'm sorry. I got to run out to the car. I can come back in. And, yeah.
Well, it's very successful. Anyway, we are here to talk about Her Deadly Game. And Bob has gone back to his original roots, writing legal thrillers, because that's what he began with. And, you know, you brought your own expertise, your own trial skills to creating this book. So what sparked it off?
I really wanted to write a fun book. I wanted to write a book that was intriguing, interesting. And I wanted to combine all the things that I like to do in my story. So it's a legal thriller, it's got police procedural, and it's got family dynamics. And I wanted all those to be a part of a story. And then the other thing I really wanted to do, and I wanted to do it for a while, was I wanted to have a chess game within the trial, a real chess game. So Kira Dugan is a prosecutor who, because of a bad relationship at work, she's forced to go to work for her father, and her father, she swore she'd never work for her father in his criminal defense firm because he's an alcoholic, lifelong alcoholic. Her two older sisters, much older sisters, work in the law firm, and they always treat her like a kid. But she was a chess prodigy growing up, because her father used to play chess, and that's how she would relate to her dad. And she stopped playing when her dad showed up at her chess tournament drunk. She wouldn't play anymore. But she plays online. I don't play chess.
Yeah. This is your second version of the Queen's Gambit.
Yeah. When I was practicing law, the best trial attorneys that I knew were really good chess players. And I asked a guy one time, why is it? And he said, well, think about it. You know, you cannot anticipate the answer you're going to get in a courtroom, because the minute you do that, you get a different answer. And if you're not prepared for that different answer, you're in trouble. And it's the same thing in a chess game. It's not the next move that matters. It's the next five moves that matter, and what the opponent does in those five moves. So I called up a friend of mine who runs a chess foundation, and he put me in touch with a guy who used to live in Bellevue, which is close to where I live, and he's moved to South Dakota. So my first question to him was, why would you move to South Dakota? And he said, I have 7 kids.
Yeah.
I can buy a house.
Okay.
So he's a grandmaster. And I sat down with him. I said, this is kind of what I want to do. And he said, let me think about it. And he did. And then he said, let me read the book as you're doing it. And I let him read the book. And he came up with a chess game. And it's a real game. And it's actually a game that he played in to win the U.S. Chess championship. With some modifications. But it's a real game. And so if people actually take out the chessboard and play it, it really played.
Yeah, so it's kind of cures relief when, you know, the trial. She comes home and takes out some of her energy and frustration in the chess game. So actually, she made that error that so many people do, actually sleeping with somebody at work, right?
She does.
It is never a good idea to do that.
And you know, she was younger, and she sort of fell for this guy. He's older than her by about 10 years. And, you know, there was just a lot of dynamics there. But the longer she dates him, the more she starts to see similarities between him and her father. He doesn't just have a glass of wine at night. He's got to have multiple glasses of wine. Or he has a cocktail and he has a glass of wine. And she just doesn't want to go down that path. And so she tries to very diplomatically and professionally just work her way out of it. But that's not going to happen because he's up here and he's the guy promoting people and et cetera. It's a really interesting dynamic. I when I was writing the Tracy Crosslight series, I talked to my source there, Jennifer Southworth, who was Seattle's first female homicide detective. And the dynamics is really interesting. You know, she said to me one time, the Seattle Police Department was getting sued for sexual harassment by a female police officer. And I said to Jen something to the effect of, you know, that must be good for you, you know, to get it. And she goes, no, we hate it. We hate it. She said, I just want to be treated as a police officer. I don't want to be treated as a woman. I just want to be treated as a police officer. That's what I do. And when these things come up, everybody backs away and they don't talk to her. They don't invite her to lunch because they don't want to deal with any of the problems. So in this situation, she tries to just sort of back away, but that's not going to happen.
No, well, you can't really speak truth to power comfortably. And since he had all the power and she didn't have any, wasn't a good idea. And I bring that up because when she goes into this difficult trial that the book is about, he is the prosecutor, making it even harder, right?
Yeah.
That didn't just happen accidentally, did it?
No. somebody emailed me one time and said, for the love of God, on every page you're just piling on top. But that's what books are about. You know, books are about overcoming these obstacles. And when one overcome one, there's another one, and another one, and another one. So, you know, they said, you know, geez, you're just really piling on this poor girl. And I was like, you know, that's what it's about. And it has to be, right? That has to be what happens.
Well, you've given her two difficult relationships to work through. One, this guy whose name I can't remember.
Miller Ambrose.
Which one is it?
Miller Ambrose.
Okay. And then you've got her father. And, you know, a lifelong binge drinker. He's a binge drinker, right? Which is very difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be easier if he just drank steadily all the time.
Yeah, my grandfather was a binge drinker, an alcoholic, and there were a number of family occasions where he would show up and he would be drunk. And I remember just the angst I would see on my mother's face. And my mother never really talked a lot about it because the Irish didn't do that back then, right? It was, they would protect him. But there were times where she did begin to talk about it. And she used to, he was a very successful dentist. And she would go out into the dental waiting room while he was in the back. And she'd say, Dr. Brannick is sick and he's not going to be able to see patients today. If you'll reschedule, we'll get you in. And they would all come back, all of them. He never would lose, he never lost patience. She said that he would always come back. Here's the really scary part. they used to then, her and her sister Atlanta used to then get in a car and he would drive them home. So that ended when he crashed the car, and they put a dental office in the apartment building that my grandparents owned, and it was down the hall, so he would not have to drive. So, you know, as I got older, my mother would say to my brother Bill and I, go to Marin County, and I can't get your grandfather on the phone. Make sure he's not dead. And I'd have to drive out to Marin County with my brother, and then he wouldn't be dead, but he'd been on a binge, and my dad would say, pull all the spark plugs out of the car. So I'd pull all the spark plugs out of the car, and then we'd clean him up, clean up the yard. You know, I never asked my mom's permission about, you know, writing about this. And, you know, she listens to books on tape because she has macular degeneration. She's 90 now, my mom. And it'd be interesting to see if she calls me on it.
If she recognizes where it came from.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is my mom's the third daughter. And Kira is the third daughter.
Key winner scenario, right? Well, I mean, the point is that when he's sober, Kira's father is actually a perfectly good functioning attorney. Because, you know, when he goes on a binge, that creates the problem. So her older sister's kind of covered.
Yeah, and I never really completely understood that, because I remember my mother telling me that my grandfather would give up drinking for Lent, which is 40 days. And I'd think, well, why would he start again? You know, but it's an interesting scenario, but he's a really good lawyer. Like my grandfather's a very good dentist. He's a really good lawyer. And Kira has received all those same traits. Her sisters are not the lawyer Kira is. She's intuitive. She's smart. She's willing to take chances. She's a really, really good lawyer.
And what she hopes is if she can nail a really big case, she can kind of upgrade the firm and also give herself a role in it that is not just a caretaking role. Because she's really smart from what happened to her, right? So yeah. Got the wrong name. Along comes Vince LaRussa.
Vince LaRussa.
That's a great name. You already know he might be good news, or he might really be bad news.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't really give away a lot of it, but that actually is, the character is actually based on a real character that was in Seattle by the name of Darren Burke. And I kind of have to leave it at that.
No, don't go any further, right? Because there are several surprises in the book, and we don't want to edge our way towards them because we'll spoil it. But what is Vince there for? We can at least talk about what's the setup.
So Vince is there because his wife, who is disabled in a horse riding accident, and is in a wheelchair, she's dead. She's in the kitchen in her wheelchair, and she's been shot in the head. And as the story begins to unfold, there's evidence that comes out that Vince had a very, very good reason, you know, to kill her. And that's where Kira gets brought in, is to defend Vince LaRussa and begin to find out, you know, all the evidence of what's going on.
But he's a noted philanthropist. He's a really rich guy. One of the tech barons? I'm trying to remember whatever his name. That's so easy to do anymore. Just call him a tech baron.
Yeah, he's a
crypto guy.
He's an investment. He runs an investment fund.
Money, nonetheless.
Yeah, right. He runs an investment fund. And he's very good at what he does, like you said. And he's very philanthropic. In fact, you know, he's number of charitable organizations that he gives to and takes care of.
In fact, he is at a major charity banquet, right? Mm-hmm. When she's killed. So he...
Supposedly.
We'll see. I believed him.
Anyway, he's, you know, he's a good client in the sense that he can clearly afford the services of the law firm.
Right. And that's what she needs. You know, the firm is, the father's alcoholism is catching up to him. And he used to be known as the Irish brawler. He was a boxer when he was 17, young, and he's not the brawler. He's not the guy that he was. This is an opportunity for Kira to bring in a big client, a lot of publicity going on, you know, all that. And if she's, you know, successful, it's going to really help the law firm.
All right. We have mentioned this is in Seattle because it could be in other cities, but it is in Seattle. And, you know, truly, a great defense attorney does need to be, in many ways, a brawler. You know, you can't be passive if you're going at it. Any of you ever seen Shakespeare's Richard II? Have you ever seen a dramatization of Richard II? Because it basically is an early trial, and it makes you realize when you watch it that you have the Black Knight and the White Knight, or however that goes. But it is essentially the same thing as a prosecutor and a defense attorney, but of course they're in a joust. They're writing against each other, and one of them is gonna win. But you know, that is the essence of a trial, essentially, in our system, is that you have two sides battling it out. You have the prosecution and the defense, and the jury is in the middle trying to work out who's really got the better story. Because that's the other thing, is that there are sometimes really nonsensical results from trials, but they result from the fact that one lawyer, despite the fact, had a better story.
Yeah, and I had a defense attorney tell me one time that his job is not to get someone off, or his job is to defend the Constitution and make sure that if the prosecution is going to convict this individual, that they follow the Constitution, that this guy is given his rights to do it, because that's the only way that the system works. Because I had asked him, it's Phil Martin. Phil writes novels. But Phil has defended, I think he had 30 capital murder cases, never had a client convicted, or never had a client given the death sentence. Had him convicted, but they didn't get the death sentence. But he told me that. He said, you know, my job is to make sure that the prosecution follows the law and follows the Constitution. And that benefits all of us.
Wow. Right, but then there are people who represent criminals and other stuff. Not every defense attorney is quite on that point.
No, they're not. I mean, we can, you know, two letters, OJ.
I can really recommend, some of you probably saw The Lincoln Lawyer when it came out as a movie with Michael McConaughey. Well, he was then too busy after that to do another one. The series has started with the second book in the Lincoln Lawyer series on Amazon with a new guy, and it's actually terrific. Once you get over, it's not Michael McConaughey, you just have to adjust, but I like this guy better. And it really is amazing, the yin and the yang of it. And it's only at the very end, I was watching it, and I read the book, but I couldn't remember it. And I said to my husband, I just can't believe it. I said, the whole thing was right there in front of me the entire time. It was right there. And, you know, the sort of, whatever you want to call it, misdirection, which is also can be. I tried a lot of criminal cases when I was back in Virginia being a lawyer. And, you know, if you could do that, if you could misdirect people away from fairly obvious evidence, you could, as I say, you could win with a better story.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of, you know, my job writing is to play fair with you, right? The worst thing is when you read a book and you get the end, you go, oh, come on. You know, that you threw that in at the end just to make it work. No, all the pieces have to be there so that when the ending comes, you go, hopefully you're going, oh my God, it was right there the whole time, you know, and I didn't see it, or I thought I saw it, I'm not quite right.
Well, that's why I suggest, if any of you are interested in this, you do watch the first season of The Lincoln Lawyer on, I think it's Amazon, your very publisher, that Michael Connelly has got, because it is a superb example of how that works. However, what I do know now is that since forensics, when I'm saying the best story, when this is based on experience, because this was long, 40 years ago for me, forensics have made a real difference. I mean, the OJ trial made a joke out of, you know, forensic evidence. But the truth is that juries now expect, you know, scientific acclaim. Not, no, that's not the right word. They want to feel that the science is guiding them to the verdict in a way that wasn't possible before we got so deep into forensics.
Yeah. And that's kind of the fun part of the 1933 book, because when you're reading the clippings, the stuff that attorneys are getting away with in court and the things they're doing and saying never happened today. Never happened today. And there is no scientific evidence back then. In fact, they were making a big deal about send this down to the lab to find out if it's the same type of blood. Like type A and type B, that was just, that came about, I think, in 1929, that the guy was able to type A and type B and type O. But that's all they had to work with.
That's right. And that's why eyewitnesses were so important. And if you know anything about eyewitnesses today, you know that eyewitnesses are really unreliable. Mm-hmm. And so people were convicted, you know, based upon testimony that wasn't perhaps knowingly false, but certainly misleading.
Yeah, and the other thing we have today is cameras, right? Everybody here has got a cell phone, right? So the minute something happens, everybody's got their cell phone on.
For sure.
I was just watching a documentary on the guy that stole Tom Brady's Super Bowl jersey. And how did they catch it? Well, they went back and they looked at all the cameras. I mean, there was like 50 cameras all over the stadium, and they found the guy that didn't belong. It's really tough to get away with anything. But one of the really interesting stories that I'm eager to see how this all plays out is the guy in Idaho.
Oh, so yeah.
He supposedly killed those four people randomly.
Yeah.
Just,
you sort of suspect him from the very beginning.
Well, there's a really interesting thing about that, and I won't use names, but I will tell you this. I was at the Riders Police Academy in Wisconsin just a little while ago, and I was supposed to be on a panel with someone that was a forensic psychiatrist. And I just got a weird vibe. I can't describe it, but you just kind of get kind of a... And so I go into the guy that was running it, and I said, I'm not going to be on that panel. And he's like, whoa, no, why? And I said, no. And I just said, just trust me on this one. I'm not going to be on that panel. And he was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. So the panel goes on. The person sees me after the panel, says, where were you? You're supposed to be on my panel. I said, oh, I just couldn't be there. I couldn't do it, blah, blah, blah. Fast forward now. They arrest the guy, and they find out that he was studying in a class. Well, guess who was teaching the class? The person who gave me the heebie-jeebies.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, and if he is convicted, it probably will be in some forensic manner, because if I remember, there are absolutely no eyewitnesses.
Yeah, no, well, he had a mask on. There was a, slowly, but anyway, they do have some DNA, because, you know, and this is what the police always tell me, is they always say to me, most criminals are idiots. And so here this guy, if he did what we think he did, and he planned this out meticulously to get away with it, which was his goal, he'd leave behind the knife sheath, which he's been touching and everything. You know, you say to a police officer, well, you know, so, and they go, because these guys are not, you know.
Yeah, but it's also possible that there's another explanation for it. So
we'll find out.
Maybe you know the Darwin Awards. Cleansing the gene pool. And it's astonishing how many criminals are part of the Darwin Awards. Love it. I mean, you know, burglars who lock themselves in freezers and other, you know, ridiculous things that happen. So how did you feel coming back to writing a legal thriller? Because it's been a while. I mean, Tracy Crosswise is a police procedural, and while there is, legal stuff in it, it's different than having a trial. A trial is a really interesting frame for a story.
It is, and I mean, I loved it just because... there's built-in tension, you know, there's built-in tension in any trial as to what's going to happen and who's going to say what and how's it going to turn and all those things. So it was fun to get back kind of in the courtroom and to work on the direct examinations versus the cross examinations without making them stilted is always hard. Barb will tell you that 90% of every trial is boring, I mean, 90% of it is just.
I even went around in the Old Bailey in London just to see if the British did it better. And it was even more boring. But the secret is there's a pub right across the street, which is where most of it retired to. But no, it's really true. There is, and there's also an incredible amount of wasted time.
Yeah.
Because things come up and, you know, people are always asking for, I mean, they have to speed it up if you're watching it as a drama.
Yeah.
But in real life, there are kind of constant continuances and people don't show up and, you know, and it can just go on.
And motions. And motions.
Which is why if you sign up for a jury, especially in a criminal trial, you could actually be there for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
It's one of the few advantages to becoming as old as I am. Not that they would let me anyway, but now, you know, my husband just, he's younger than I am, just got a jury summons today and then pointed out to the court that he was, you know, past the age.
Yeah.
Which I think it's too bad. I actually always wanted to serve other than as a plaintiff, as an attorney, but I always wanted to sit on a jury, but nobody would ever let me do it.
So I had an incident where, I got called and I got called down into the box. And it was a case of the prosecutor was going after a guy that they said he was distributing child pornography on the internet. So the prosecutor said to the I was juror number six. So he says to juror number one, you know, if you were a police officer and somebody was speeding and you pulled them over, blah blah blah. Yes. Juror number two, yes. Juror number three, yes. Juror number four, yes. Come to me, juror number six. And I said, why is he speeding? And you can just see the guy just go blind. And I said, he might have a good reason for speeding. If he has a good reason for speeding, then the answer would be no. And the woman, juror number one, goes, I want to change my answer. So about 5 minutes later, we'd like to thank and excuse juror number six. So I stand up to leave, and the judge says, Mr. Degoni. And I turn around and I look, yes, Your Honor. Say hello to David Sloan for me.
David Sloan, for those who don't know, was just the original lawyer character.
She knew my books.
Oh, what fun. So today you can actually be a celebrity juror. Have you noticed that, I mean, jurors now get to do this tell-all thing? That woman in Georgia on the grand jury, you know, has decided to rock her, you know, her time under, and they stir up the entire prosecution. And, you know, so I'm wondering if we're going to have to rewrite. I mean, jurors may need to not only be cloistered during the trial, but there may have to be gag orders for them. You know, how people sign official secret acts during World War II so that, you know, people who served at Bletchley, for example, never could tell their families they were actually outbreaking and all bit for like 30 years after the war was over. I'm thinking that might become a necessary thing because, you know, grounds for appeal if jurors do stuff like that or reveal how they got to their verdict, they're just creating endless amounts of appeal material.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That would actually be an interesting thing to write about in case you're looking for a plot.
It makes a hero
button. That was a question I wanted to ask you. She's such a good character. You're not just going to retire her.
No. The goal is to make it a series, to turn it into a series. And you know that a lot of series are three books.
They're called trilogies.
Trilogies. and for whatever reason, it's the third book, and people seem to say, okay, I've had enough of it. You know, I've just been really blessed with the Tracy Crosswhite series. We just keep picking up readers, more and more and more readers. So, you know, people ask me all the time if I'm going to go back to Charles Jenkins. Well, that story's sort of been told.
Yeah.
So if I do, it'd be a whole other thing. But this one, I would like to continue to write her story. I think it's very rich in people, which is really what you want as an author. Is there's a lot of different characters in the story that can play a part as the story goes on. And that's sort of what happened with Tracy Crosswhite. It's not just Tracy Crosswhite. It's you know, Kins and Del Castigliano and Vic Fazio and you know, Johnny Nolasco, and now the new chief of police. And so, you know, just keep layering on these people, and it just makes a lot of fun.
Well, it is a lot of fun. And, you know, the other thing is there aren't that many legal thrillers currently being written. I'm obviously a fan of them. And, you know, there used to be all kinds of guys, Steve Martini, for example, and, you know, and somehow or other, there's trends in publishing, you know. Somehow, you know, you get like, for, you know, I'm not going to be able to read another World War II women's story. And I'm told at the tall list at one publisher, that's like all there is. And, you know, but I think it's too bad that things get so oversaturated that it becomes so hum. But for whatever reason, the legal thriller, which was a really hot ticket for a long time, has fallen into abeyance. And so you're on trend to come back up again. And, you know, if they work better if they're written by people who actually know what they're... You know, John Le Squire, for example, writes really terrific legal thrillers. I love his books. But he has a lifelong friend who is a very good attorney who, you know, makes sure that everything in the books actually works for Dismas Harding and that crew.
Right.
But, you know, you already know your material, so, and you certainly can't run out of potential plots.
No, I mean, you can't make it up. You just pick up the newspaper and it's like, really? There's always things where I think the key for the legal thriller is to not make it just a courtroom story. Because, you know, that's the thing that everybody, all of us, right, we're not just what we do for a living. And so, you know, we're husbands or wives or we're parents, you know, or we're daughters or sons. And that's really, I think, what I tried to do with Kira was to capture her world, the world that she's living in. Because, you know, a great example was I can remember going to a deposition, and this was a really important deposition, and I wasn't sitting first chair, but the guy that was sitting first chair was putting together a model car, while he was asking the guy questions. Well, why are you doing that? And so I had a break. I said, what the hell are you doing? He said, my son's got a Hot Wheels Derby contest. I didn't make the car for him, and so I'm working. I got to get the car done for my son's Hot Wheels Derby. And that was real life. You know, that was what this guy had to do.
I thought it was a brilliant distraction to me. Wow. Well, you're absolutely right. I had a very nice conversation last night with a young woman called Gigi Pandian, who is writing, has brought the Lockbird Mystery, which was a form of fiction very popular in the Golden Age, and it's often confused with a book like And Then There Were None. But a Lockbird Mystery is basically an impossible crime. It happens in some kind of sealed environment, and it appears that nobody could actually have killed whoever the dead person is. So the whole point of a Lockbird Mystery is not who did it or why they did it, but how they did it.
Right.
How did they do it? And it's a form that was very, very popular, and then it's hard to do because, you know, if you're going to set it up, you also have to figure out how it worked. As you, the author, you know, you could really write yourself into some terrible places. But anyway, what she was talking about is that the older ones were mostly mechanical. There wasn't a lot of character development. It was all about the puzzle. So what she's done, which I think is wonderful, she's actually from a multiracial family. And so she said she wanted to have characters in the book that were like her family. She has an Indian father and a Scottish mother, or maybe that's the people in the book. But anyway, however it goes. And there's a lot of food in it. You know, so she's enriched the basic mechanism of the Lockner mystery as the story by bringing in all these other things, you know. And it's called the Secret Staircase Mysteries because it's an architectural firm, and what they do is they create, you know, hidden rooms. I just love it. I want to hire them. I just really do. Wouldn't it be fun? I mean, you think about, you know, secret pre-souls and secret staircases and castles and, you know, fake doors and bookshelves, you know, you pivot. Or if you read Orphan X, for example, you'll know that Evan has a, you know, you go into a shower and then the whole back wall falls away and there's a secret room. So, you know, how cool is it to have one of those?
No, very.
But she's made the same point that you were just making, which is you could take the basic Perry Mason sort of, which, let me tell you what, there is no way that Perry Mason could ever successfully, you know, he couldn't have gotten away with almost all the stuff that he did. Of course, it was ridiculous.
You read these clippings and you're like, some of the stuff these guys were doing in court.
Well, that's true. He does those a long time.
He never did it. And that's another, you raise a good point. That's another thing I wanted this to be a puzzle book. You know, how did this happen? You know, and the way that it's set up, I had to call a number of different people to help me, you know, put it together.
Yes, you did.
But I wanted to be a puzzle.
I was trying to envision you. When you get to the end, try to envision Bob actually walking through what happened. It will give you lots of entertainment as you do that. Right. I'm hoping you didn't actually do it.
No.
That was my fond hope, and I thought, who did he practice on? But no.
Well, and then you know, you get to the end and you think you're done, and suddenly you go, what about? So you call my buddy up and then, what about? And he goes, oh shit. Yeah, we gotta figure this out. You know? So yeah, puzzle books are hard. They're hard.
Well, anyway, I love Kira, and I hope you're going to, at least you're going to bring her back. So since you produce a book like every 6 months, you're more regular than pregnancies, what is it that you're going to present next? Because I feel sure there is a book coming out in a few months.
Yeah, no, I have a lot going on. So the next Tracy Crosswhite book will come out. It's called One Last Kill. And people are going, is that the end of the series? No, it's not the end of the series. But it's the end of the trilogy within the 10-book series. So I wrote a short story called The Last Line. Then I wrote What She Found. And now this book coming out plays off of those three. I thought it'd be fun. I always try to challenge. I told you this before. I always try to challenge myself because it makes it interesting when I'm writing the book. So I wanted a trilogy within the 10-book. So One Last Kill will be out, I think, in the summer.
Then, it's usually August, if you're on schedule.
Yeah, and then the Pom Pom Club murder, which is going to be called A Murder on the Hill.
Come on, you should use the name of the hill. You really should have the name of the hill, don't you think? Much more punch.
I'll take that up with the powers that be. We ran that through. And then I'm actually doing something I've never done before, but it's a World War II book. But it's not a woman. It's actually based upon a true story. And what happened was these two guys did an incredible amount of research. I mean, like, unbelievable amounts of research on a story, World War II story, that's really never been told. And it's a story about Japanese hell ships. What happened was when the war was coming to an end, there was the Japanese defense minister issued an order which the United States intercepted because they had code breakers.
Right.
And one of the characters in the book is a code breaker. And they the order said, kill all the POWs. Kill them all. So they took them and they put them on these ships. And they used them as human shields. And so it's the story of this guy coming from a small town in Minnesota. Girl that he loves. And he joins the National Guard thinking he'll be safe. And it gets federalized by FDR, and he's off. He goes to the Philippines, and then the Japanese invade. And it's the story of which, anyway, these guys couldn't write the book, or they tried to write the book, they just couldn't get it to where it needed to be. And I knew them, and they came to me and said, "Would you be willing to do this?" And my initial reaction was, "No, I have too many of my own projects going on." But they did so much work. It would have been a crime for the story not to be out there given the amount of research that they did. So I'm doing it, and it's called Hold Strong, and that'll be out, I think, in like a year. And after that, the next Kira.
Well, somewhere in there, we'll be with Brian. Bob and I will be together, but I don't know if it'll be here or some of it probably will be. It's cruel to bring somebody here in August. But interestingly enough, here's a great statistic. We've had more rain in Phoenix since August than Seattle. So, you know, maybe not.
Well, you guys get the downpours. We get the sprinkles.
We get California.
Yeah.
That's probably what it is those, you know, those river, whatever they call them, atmospheric rivers, yeah. They just keep on coming. I mean, we're having a wildfire season that is just absolutely astonishing. All you have to do is drive. I was driving up Scottsdale Road towards Mayo today, and on both sides of the road, they're extraordinary wildfires. Yeah. My daughter was at the botanical garden today and said it's absolutely terrific. And going to Tucson for Left Coast Crime, my husband and I left early enough to go to Picacho Peak. But the only thing that was different at Picacho Peak from our very own garden was the lupins, which are beautiful. Yes. But otherwise, mm-hmm. the poppies and the, you know, and we have fenced them and they're gorgeous. And so, you know, it's a remarkable spring,
yeah.
which may lead to a remarkable fire season.
Yeah.
But that's all a different question. All right, why don't you take questions?
Yes, I'll take questions. Anyone?
How does the reception of sand compare to World Dead Chest?
Can you repeat the question too, Bob?
Yeah, so how was the reception of the extraordinary lack of Sam Hell to the World Play Chest? Sam is way up here, but the reason is interesting. It was really, when people read the World Play Chest, they go, oh my God, I didn't know that's what the book was about. They think it's a war book because if you look at the cover, right, it looks like it's a war book. But it's really not a war book. It's a coming-of-age book. So the World Play Chess is starting to have a revival, and it's having a revival at the book clubs because the book clubs are starting to find it, and then they're starting to tell other people about it. But Sam is a book that just universally, you know, it struck people on an emotional level. Yeah, that was hard to replicate. I really think that the World Play Chess is probably the most difficult book that I've ever written, so I think it's probably my best book in that respect. I wanted it to be accurate. I didn't want it to be, you know, and I've gotten a lot of really heartfelt emails from people that were in Vietnam, and they said, this is exactly the way it was. So, yeah.
I read your book, Wrongful Death. And that was one of your first books. And it was going to Iraq right after that. I read it. And I was like, Wrongful Death was about cheap vest. I like everybody. Everybody read that at the man. It's like.
My cousin was over there. When we found out that he was going to be there, my kids were young at the time. We packaged up Girl Scout cookies and books, and including that book, and sent a bunch of them over there. And he handed them out to all the people that were in the yeah. I mean, you know, police officers, veterans. You know, you can't thank them enough for what they do. And I get all these emails from people saying, you know, thank you for writing what really happened. And I say, no. Thank you for your service, for what you did. Because it's just, you know, it's horrific what those guys go through. You think about what's going on in Ukraine right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just the bombs and everything. It's just so many people's lives. One day were fine and they were going, and now it's just gone. Just gone. It's just so sad. Yeah.
I just have a couple of comments. Number one, I love that you read some of your own audiobooks.
Oh.
Because no one can tell their own story like the person who wrote it, and it adds just a complete other dimension to it when we read it. So I know it's probably long and hard and all that stuff, but it's much appreciated.
Oh, thank you.
As is your interaction with us on Facebook. You know, you throw out great questions, get your readers involved, and I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate that.
Thank you.
It makes us feel like we know you. You know, here's your pictures on vacation and your wife's birthday present. And I can tell you how blessed you've been this last year. and it's just, but it makes me feel like I know you, and I think it helps build reader loyalty.
Well,
I want to help support this guy, you know?
No, I hope so. You know, I learned a long time ago that social media is not a place to go and put your opinions up. It's just not. I mean, because, you know, you could say that it's a clear sky today, and you're going to get 100 people to say, you're out of your mind. And so I try to keep it, you know, light. I mean, and the other thing, you know, you have to be careful about is, there's a lot of people that aren't as fortunate or as blessed as I am to do some of the things that I'm doing. And so you don't want to put it out there and look like, you know, you're showing off or anything like that. So there's a delicate balance there. The reading of the books, I was told, so when I was asked to read The Extraordinary Life of Sam Houth, I had people tell me, you are going to hate it. You're going to go there and you're going to be, it's going to take about 5 days, and you're going to go there and the first half day you're going to be, oh, this is great. And after that, you're going to hate it. I loved it. I loved it from, I'm an old actor. And somebody says to you, we'd like you to, and you get to play every part. That's like, sign me up. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was hard. I had to do it in Grand Haven, Michigan, so it was hard to get there. But I loved it. And I've been asked to do other ones, like the Charles Jenkins series. But that, you know, there's Russian in there. Not only Russian accents, but Russian words. And I said, no, get Eduardo Ballerini to do it. Because that guy is phenomenal. And he agreed. And he's done the 3 Charles Jenkins books. And those are spectacular.
Well, and you did The World Played Chess as well.
It's part of The World Played Chess. Very interesting story. So they sent me 3 tapes of the people that were going to read the part of William. And I listened to the 3 tapes, and they were all good. But there was one guy that really stood out. I mean, he sounded like Richard Dreyfuss, right? He had that New Jersey accent down perfectly. And I said, this is the guy I want. And they said, we're so glad you picked him. He was first generation Vietnamese. And he read it. Yeah. I wish I had met him. I've never met him, never even spoken to him, but I would like to at some point.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
David Sloan, will we see him again?
That's a complicated question. And it's complicated because I started the David Sloan series with Jury Master at Hachette. And then I went to Simon & Schuster and I wrote 4 books with them. Now I'm with a new publisher. And, you know, honestly, I had to kind of fight a little bit to do the Charles Jenkins book. I had to say, this is not a David Sloan book. This is a Charles Jenkins book. It's a spinoff. And then the other thing that gets really complicated is we sold the rights to the Charles Jenkins series to CBS. So they have it, and they're in the process of looking for a screenwriter to do a television series. But then you have, in the contracts, they'll say, well, you know, you have David Sloan in this book, so if we buy it, we get the rights to the David Sloan books. No. So now I have to change the name of David Sloan so they can have a new character. Well, you put it at the beach house. Well, that's in the David Sloan. So, you know, there's just a lot of complications to it. So I don't know. I really like his character, but it just, there's other factors outside of my control.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
You said that you were a lawyer originally. Had you always wanted to be a writer and just became a lawyer, or because nobody becomes a writer who needs to raise a family?
No, there's a couple things. So I'm one of 10 kids, and I'm the middle child. And my brothers and sisters are all compulsive overachievers. They're all doctors. And they're really, really high achieving individuals. And so I just always had a love of books. I just was in Naples, Florida, and I was speaking to a luncheon of 900 people. Just really lovely, lovely people. And I would, to support the books in Collier County, to support the libraries in Collier County. So I was talking about growing up in a library, because where else can a mother of 10 take their kids and have somebody else tell you to shut up? So she would take us to the library, and she would grab these books for us to read. My mom used to be an English teacher before she started having kids. And I started reading all these books, like The Count of Monte Cristo and The Old Man and the Sea and The Great Gatsby and Of Mice and Men. And just, you know, she just handed me, read this one. And I fell in love with stories. So I knew right away that's what I wanted to do, right? That's what I wanted to do. I went to high school and I had a very abbreviated athletic career where my coach, Red Sam Howell, said to me, "You can't shoot, you can't dribble, and you can't play defense. What am I going to do with you?" Put me on the team, coach. No. They need someone to edit the newspaper. So I went and I edited the newspaper, and that really helped me get into Stanford University. And I worked on the newspaper there, and I got a job at the LA Times, and I was going to, you know, stay along that path. But then, you know, as we all do, you have these, you know, moments in our lives where, you know, it's like, they're going to send me to some really small little podunk, you know, and I'm 22 years old, and do I want to go there? And my buddies are all going to law school, and I'm going to go to law school. And then you get debt, and you get on the treadmill. And then I got in a great law firm. I mean, the place I worked was, I'd love to write a book about that, but I can't because everybody's still alive. I get sued. But it was, I mean, you talk about, it was an amazing place to work for a lot of reasons. And then I was 39. My daughter was born, and my daughter had not been born yet. My son was 18 months old, and I was sitting at home Saturday morning, San Francisco, had a little house in San Francisco, my wife and I. And I couldn't do it anymore. I was in a really difficult trial. And I just woke up and I said to my wife, I can't do this anymore. And God love her, she just said, then we won't. And I would not be here today if it was not. She supported me for 3 years. She encouraged me. You know, every time I'd be down, you know, Simon Schuster lets me go. You know, she was the one that was always there to say, it's going to take time, but you'll get there. It's going to take time, but you're going to get there. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. And I couldn't have done it without her, right? I mean, what's the old saying is, you know, behind every man is a good woman. Well, in my case, she's in front of me. And Barb knows my wife, so she'll tell you, yeah, she was in front of you.
She's absolutely wonderful. So, you know, you've been very fortunate. As I said, here you are living, in the words of your publisher who writes to me, you're living your best life.
Yeah, I really am. I mean, you know, This is gonna sound patronizing, and I don't mean it to, but you know, one of the best parts of this is all of you. I mean, honestly, I went to Naples, Florida, and you know, just met so many really wonderful, interesting people. Mike, you know, and Melanie. I mean, Mike, I was going to Dallas, and he said, "Hey, you're coming to Dallas. Come to my insurance firm. I want to show you around, and you know, bring your books and." I mean, how long have we known each other now? Since then? 10 years, 15 years? Right? And so it's a blessing to be able to get up every day and to go and do what you love to do. It's a blessing, and I don't take that lightly. And that's something that my mother really instilled in us. And, you know, the other thing is I do a lot of book clubs online. I do a lot of Zoom events. And I counted them. I did 70 in the last 2 years. And people are like, I love them. And when we get done, you know, they always want to say, you know, thank you for coming. And I really mean this when I say this is, no, I mean, it's really humbling for someone to email you and say, we'd like to talk to you about what you do for a living. Would you be willing to come and tell us what? And that's really humbling to have somebody ask you to do that. So, I'll never take it for granted. I just won't. Maybe that's part of being one of 10 kids, right? You know?
Probably is. And your mother, I'm sure, had a great deal to do with it.
Yeah.
So that's a great note on which to end. So let's thank Bob for another wonderful time.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.